Hello and welcome to the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michaela, and today I have the pleasure to be talking to Alpa Kemal Koç, who is a software engineer at a startup in Turkey called Quidka. Quidka helps users to be more efficient when building mobile apps. It's a low-code solution so that users can build mobile apps based on already implemented building blocks. Alpa has been there right from the start. He was the first engineer on the team, experiencing the whole startup lifecycle from working on the initial idea and implementing the prototype to working with the first customers and getting his hands dirty helping the company succeed. So there is tons to talk about today. I'm really happy that Alpa, you're here. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having time for me.
Well, maybe let's start with how did you come to work at a startup? Why did you choose that path and what led you there?
Well, as like most engineers, most of us like greenfield projects. So startups usually give you the chance for that. And I have always worked in relatively smaller companies. They were either startups or they used to be startups and they're just in the next phase. When Quidka was starting, I was living in Holland. And our founder is someone I knew already before. And he said, if I wanted to join, I said, yeah, I like the idea. And I always like startups anyways. So I moved back to Turkey for this actually in 2015. And I've been working here since then.
So have you been one of the first engineers on that project?
Indeed, I am. I am the employee number one.
Wow.
Yeah, I have been doing the whole architecture. And we have been, it was just two of us at the beginning for like a couple months. Then we hired two more engineers and it was just four of us. We did only research and development for, I think, almost 20 months or something. And we were making all the technical decisions or the architectural decisions and technology choice, everything. So I have been deeply involved since the beginning.
So I imagine that this friend of yours comes with this idea to have this low-code platform and then you're like fire for it. And then you start really from scratch understanding if it's even feasible, what you're going to do and what your requirements are for that project.
Yes, indeed. Our founder is much more experienced than me, so he knows the field. He had seen this opportunity like every time they're building software projects. Most of the time, you're repeating the same problems that every software engineer is solving most of the time, and they are taking a lot of time. So we thought like, yeah, why don't we just wrap those up in some ready components and the engineer really focuses on the business requirements, but not the all the hassle around it. So they can just focus on the requirements. They just build their user interface and you get the app.
And when you start out with this idea, how do you decide on which technologies you should use?
Well, I think for the first month, we did a lot of research. We looked into all the popular technologies back then. And let me put it this way, there were two sides to the research. First of all, we were going to build a tool that generates tools, that generates apps. So we did the research on both sides. So what should be the technology of the tool itself, of the platform itself? And what kind of technology and apps should be producing? And on the end product side, so what we generate, we decided to go with hybrid technologies, for example. So we wouldn't get into the problem of producing code for both Android and iOS. So that was like one decision we made. And the popular technology back then was Ionic, but it still is. But I think it was Ionic version 1 back then. And we kind of did some reverse engineering. So that was one fun part of it. We didn't build our tool. We forgot about it. We picked up a scenario. We actually built a mobile app that's, you know, nice to use, easy to build. And from there, we went back. So we talked like, okay, what should we do to produce this code?
So you mean that first you actually produced your use case and then you produced the tool that would produce that use case?
Yes, exactly. So we had an app at the beginning, like on the first month or second month that we never used, but it would be kind of what our customers would want or what they would be aiming to build with Quidka. So that kind of dictated the decisions we made.
And did you change some of the initial ideas that you had on the tech stack? So did some of the technologies change over time?
It definitely did. At the beginning, we had this architecture, like we had a lot of backend code. We had a lot of C#.NET. And we had a multi-tier architecture. That architecture never changed, but the emphasis, like the focus where most of the intellectual property lies, has changed a little bit, because we were focusing a lot on implementing the business logic on the backend with C#.NET, but that was kind of slowing us down a little bit. And we at some point we saw, okay, JavaScript is giving us a little bit more power and a little bit more opportunities. So just naturally, all by itself, we kind of switched our focus to the JavaScript and front end side. That doesn't mean we changed the architecture. Architecture has always been the way it is. But I mean, the most of the business logic that's been implemented has shifted a little bit.
Okay, and so maybe to give our listeners also some idea, how old is that startup right now?
We started in September 2015. So in 2 months, it's going to be exactly 4 years.
And how mature is it?
Well, for the first 2 years, we did only the research. And at the beginning of our second year, we released our product to our initial customers. And it has been growing up since then. I think this kind of project is difficult to say it's okay, it's now mature, because we are generating apps, we are generating software, and the technology is changing every day. So we always need to keep up to it. So it will probably never gonna be mature. But currently we have, I think, around 15 customers, and we are... we are capable of satisfying their needs. We have been building apps with the platform. Those apps are live and being used in those companies right now.
Well, if you're developing software at a startup and it's only you at the beginning, and then, you know, the team slowly grows, well, how do you grow in the same time the software methodologies and the best practices and things like that? Have you been conscious about that at the beginning, or was there a very different attitude when you did the research than what you have now that you actually have customers? Was there some shift?
Well, we have been through a lot of phases on that, and we have been strict on that since day one. I was living in Holland before, and I have been experienced a lot of methodologies being implemented there, like strictly and tailored to the needs of the company, the organization. So even from day one, the first thing we talked about, okay, what's our methodology? How are we going to do this? Not what we are going to do it, but like, okay, what's going to be the process and everything? Well, the first month or two, it was just two of us. There wasn't much methodology, like rules and stuff, but we were talking about it. But once we grew, we said, okay, let's look into Agile, let's look into Scrum, let's look into Kanban and how we can implement those. And I think like every 3-4 months, we changed the methodology, or we came up with a relatively different implementation of the methodology ourselves, because our needs changed. At the very beginning, we were doing a lot of research, we were doing a lot of experiments. It was not very easy to make estimations. It was not easy to make long-term plans. Then we said, okay, here's our methodology. We are going to make quarterly visionary goals, and we are going to do Kanban. So, you know, we will have goals, and we will define the topics, and we are going to pick those up one by one. After we meet those goals in the first quarter, let's say for the next quarter or the next 5-6 months, I don't know, we have a more clear path to go. So we could define what we are going to do. So we kept switching in between depending what we need at the time. And after 2 years, we started having customers, and that brought us to a whole new world where we had to run projects with the customers and some of our customers didn't know about those methodologies, or you cannot apply some of those methods to the project management within two organizations. So we kind of picked, like we did some cherry picking from different methodologies and implemented something for every project or our own work here within our team.
So one of the things that struck me when you were talking about why and how you use different methodologies, you said, well, I have been in the Netherlands before. So do you think that culturally there is a difference between the Netherlands and, for example, Turkey on how much methodology driven organizations, software organizations are?
I think there is. I haven't worked in Germany, but what I have been hearing from friends like Germany, Holland, or the more countries around that, the more north you go, being on time, like being punctual and being strict about plans has more value. People appreciate that more. But the more east or south you go, it is still important, but not as much. That makes a huge difference. And I moved to Holland, and every stand-up meeting is so strict on the same time, same minute, not 1 minute later, not 1 minute earlier. If you're late, you miss it, simple as that. But it is difficult to do it that strict here. So there is definitely a difference in culture.
So it means that in Turkey, if the stand-up, if the people are a little bit late, it's normal, like 5 minutes later.
Well, yeah, Istanbul is also one of the biggest cities in the world and one of the cities that has a lot of traffic problems. So people can be late. And yeah, also if you're a small team, yeah, you don't want to miss one person. And, you know, you can't just say, yeah, you missed today's stand-up. So we wait for like 5, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. You adjust to it.
So you're saying that you looked a lot into different methodologies. What about, for example, testing? Has testing been a part of your software engineering process from the beginning on? Or is it just something that now that you're getting customers more relevant? What's your experience there?
Well, to be very honest, it has been a problematic part of our work process. We have tried different ways of testing. Like, let's say one person from the team is responsible for testing, but that's manual testing. Okay, so something is released, you want to check something that we have not broken in the graphical user interface, or we are still producing the same code. And yeah, every person is different, as anybody would agree. So people are not that careful or anything, and manual testing has been, I think, already in the past age. So we said, okay, we have to automate this. We have to find a different solution to that. So just like our methodology, our testing process has had its own phases as well. We haven't, unfortunately, done a lot of TDD, so we don't have a good test unit test suite. But 6 months through, after we started, we said we are missing out some bugs, so we have to automate this. And we came up with this idea of writing our own tool. We said, okay, what's the most important thing for us? Okay, we are producing apps. What's the most important thing? We want to make sure we are building the same app or the same code, and we make sure that, let's say, we release an app to a customer, and there's an update 2 months later, we should be releasing the exact same code. We should be generating the exact same code. Of course, also considering if there are changes, of course, we need to accept those. So we wrote a tool that we register all the apps we are working on, all the projects we are working on, and it runs every morning or manually during the day and checks that we are building the exact same thing again. If it is not exactly the same, it gives us a warning. We can look through it shows us the changes, and we can either accept it or we catch the bug that we haven't noticed while we are writing the code. It is a simple tool, but it has saved us a lot of time, and it has caught a lot of things that we hadn't thought while we were designing the system, a new feature or writing the code. So that has been like pretty much the main backbone of our testing process.
How about code reviews, for example? Is that something that you do in a small team of four right now? Or how many are you at this moment? How many engineers?
Currently, I think we are seven. We have always done code reviews. Maybe not very strict at some times, but we always did. That's also like our second insurance on the platform. We have tried two methods on that, and one of them was like, okay, I would be doing the code reviews because the structure we had most of the time, it was me and our founder, the two seniors, and we had either junior engineers or maybe with a couple years of experience. So we said, okay, let's let the seniors do the code review. So we would always do the code review. That worked fine, but that put a lot of obviously workload on us. And at sometimes we said, okay, everybody does the code review. And we had this rule that each feature or each change goes through three people, the developer, and that person is supposed to be doing the development test, obviously, and the code or the changes goes to the person B who does the code review, and the third person would be manually testing it. So we had tried both methods, and they both worked fine, actually. And at some point, obviously, after a couple of years, you have some experience, you have some traditions of your own in the company. So we have our own, you cannot really say notation, but we have some rules on how we write the code, on what are the patterns and stuff like that. And once people get used to it, most people follow, and that also works fine. So.
So one of the things that you just mentioned was like after some time you get used to, and you also explained that at the beginning you did a lot of iterations and retrospectives. Do you think that right now you're still doing that enough, that you're still looking with the same critical eye on your processes and tools and things, how you do it as at the beginning? Or do you think that over time there's something like, you know, you're getting very comfortable with how you do things and you're missing out maybe on some of the improvements?
Well, we are still strict on it, just like we were on day one. We still do the retrospectives, and we still come up with new ideas. And sometimes we also drop something that we have been doing for 2 years because all of a sudden it's not that useful anymore. So it keeps changing. It's still just like the day one. And we have new teammates who also have their own ideas, or simply they can't adjust to the methods we have, and that's also fine. Then we adjust to them. So if it's the most important thing is that the whole team and every individual, this is a small team, so every individual's contribution is really important. So if one person is not comfortable with, or we can't any benefit out from something, we talk about it during the retrospective and we drop it or we change it. So we still keep iterating.
That sounds really important. As you say, in a small team, everybody should be able to provide the best work that she or he can. Is there an example that comes to your mind where you actually dropped one of the methods because of one person, and how did you address that?
Well, what we had, for example, what we wanted to start this month, this at the beginning of this year, is there was this thing called Google Heads, like 20% thing. You know, engineers would have 20% of their time to work on their own projects, and we said, okay, let's do that. And not everybody could contribute to it. Not everybody have ideas. People are really happy with the work they are planned to do, and they are not, they just simply don't like to come up with something new. And okay, if not everybody is benefiting from that, and there is an imbalance in the team because we reserve some time for it and some people can do it, some people can't, we just drop it. And another thing we dropped was the actual code reviews again. So And we have a few junior engineers right now, and I wanted to start doing the code reviews like with all of them. So I said, okay, everybody is going to do the code reviews. and it just didn't work out for some of them. Maybe it was too early. Yeah, they simply didn't know what to do with it, so we dropped it. We will probably bring up the topic again in like 6 months after a little bit more experience. Then maybe we will start doing it again.
So that's really interesting, and I like that it's so, well, so personally adjusted. But how do people address those issues? So I imagine if I'm a junior and I'm not comfortable with doing the code reviews, do you just see that those person doesn't contribute, or are they walking up to you and tell you that they are not comfortable with it? So how does that actually work?
Yeah, one of the advantages of being a small team is like we are literally sitting 1 meter away from each other, and we don't really do one-on-ones. So if somebody wants to say something, yeah, we just say it out loud in the office right now, right then. That's the kind of culture we want to have. And if some person says, yeah, I'm not comfortable with doing this, or I don't know how to do this, we encourage them to say that. One thing we keep telling our new team members is the most important thing that you should do is say, tell us if you can't do it, if you don't understand something, just say it. That's the most value you can add. I believe there are two things the engineers are hired for. One of them is to say no. And the second thing is to say that they can't do it. That's so valuable. That's really important. Because then we can change, like, okay, let's switch the person. Let's say someone else should do it. Or maybe you should do it with another person, like a pair program. So you exchange your methods, you exchange your perspectives. And that also contributes. So that's the kind of culture we impose. And also in the retrospectives, we do round robins. So everybody has to say at least one positive thing and one negative thing about the last week or the last 2 weeks. That also encourages people to say things out loud. So nobody is running the meeting, but everybody is saying something about it.
So you said that, for example, this 20% rule didn't work for all of the people, but it worked for some. So if your decision then is to drop those 20% project time, what about the people that actually liked that idea? How did they deal with that?
Yeah, they were free to keep working on that, and they actually did. One of our friends, that's one funny story actually that we also tell our customers. It tells a lot about our product. We had this new team member that started at the beginning of this year who was going to get married in a couple months. And, you know, in most of the countries, they send out invitations. So his family was going to send out some invitations. And the family was having difficulties. Okay, what's the list of people that we are supposed to send those invitations to? And who is going to give to who? And which ones have we delivered already? And our friend here said, okay, I'm working at this company that I can build mobile apps with now, and it's really fast. So he said, can I build an app? Can I use my time on that? I said, yeah, sure. And he built this small app in a couple of days, and his family used it for those invitations. They registered all the people they wanted to invite. So yeah, that person was benefiting from that thing. So he kept on doing it.
Yeah, I can imagine that if people can use somehow work time also to, well, learn, that can be beneficial for both sides. From this project, he probably learned a lot about the use case of your product yourself, right? Because he was sort of like the customer and could give feedback. Was that the reason why you decided that he can do that?
Exactly. Yeah, we had like two reasons. One of them was like, thanks to that thing he did, he experienced how a person or a company can approach to a project. So he had to collect his requirements. He had to talk to his family. He had to decide what he needs to make. He had his own time limit, so he had to finish it in a certain time. So he made his own priorities and in considering the features, and he completed that. So that was a lot of benefits to him. Another benefit was he became a customer of our of our own product. That's something really important. We can keep writing, we can build this awesome tool. We love it, it's great, but we will really understand the value, we will really understand what we are doing if we are the customer of our own product. That's the thing that was really nice for him. He became our customer, so he had a much better perspective on our tool. He had a lot of feedbacks, and when he was building new features, he knew what it literally would mean to our users.
So in general, customer feedback, I think, is something that's really valuable and very, very important for especially a startup that maybe even has to find some product market fit first. How do you engage your customers? How do you communicate with them? How do you understand what their needs are and if you are fulfilling that?
Yeah, because we are still at the beginning, we don't have a lot of customers. So we haven't had a need for a tool for that. So we are talking to them one-on-one. We talk to our users and we get a lot of requests from them. We also integrated some ticketing and feature requesting system in our tool. They can also fill in the form there. One important thing though for a startup that's really risky, you can always get a lot of feedback from your users, and they will have some feedback, especially if you ask for it, the more you will get. But if you're building a new product and you're trying to find your way, you really need to think through those requests, because they can also easily take you off your path, because every customer will have their own needs and they will be asking specific things. So you should be searching for patterns. So let's say we have this customer A who is asking for a feature nobody else wants. And that also comes with its own cost. So that's almost like doing a custom development for that person. But if this customer B is asking for something that also our customer C and D kind of needs it, that has a higher priority. So that has been actually a real challenge for us to prioritize. I mean, first collect the user feedback, first collect the requests, then think them through, then prioritize. And also, actually, the third important thing is to ask the user or ask the customer, why do you need this for? Because we had this, and that has to be a long conversation. You really need to dive deep. The reason for that is most of the time we have seen the customer needs something and they are thinking, how can I implement this? And they come up with this solution. That's not always the correct one, and for that solution they are asking for a feature. If they had told us the initial reason why they got into this loop, maybe we already had a feature for that, or it could be a lot simpler, or it could be maybe for everybody. So we always also try to understand why the user is asking for that thing, because there is usually something else lying under.
One of the things that for a startup also interests me is the deployment process. How does that work? Is that a click of a button that deploys a new version of your system, or is there more manual labor also involved? Who can do it?
Well, unfortunately, I cannot say it's fully automated, but it's not manual either. So it's kind of a mix. And we have three stages. We have a test environment, an alpha environment, and a live environment. And we deploy to our test environment every day, every night, or every morning, like every 24 hours. And that's also the environment that we run our testing tool on. And to our alpha and live environment, we release like once a week. Most of the process is automated, but it's supervised manually. I mean, it's like kind of a script. And one of us sits in front of the computer, runs the script, and just makes sure that everything's fine. Also, the test environment, the test suite part, yeah, that's kind of manual. I mean, like you click a button and it gives you the results and you need to look through them, accept the differences, or if something is awkward, then that person raises a flag and say, okay, something is wrong in yesterday's changes. So, yeah, so it's kind of a mix.
your employee number one. What were your biggest useful resources? How did you learn? How did you grow? How did you know how to implement which architecture, which methodologies to use and all of that? What was your North Star, or what was your fuel for learning? Is it books? Is it podcasts? Is it other people?
Well, I would say Google most of the time. And yeah, we do have a small library of books here. And we thought, okay, we can go through books. But yeah, the books at least we had would give us more information for a specific technology. But just like you said, at the very beginning, the initial questions we had was like, okay, what should the architecture be? And what should the technologies we should be using? So we had to first pick those and then dive into the books. That was one thing we were lucky about. And our experiences are from our previous jobs and software development experiences. We had been exposed to a couple of architectures, like software-oriented architectures or multi-tier setups. And obviously, we first talking about the things we already know about. And that already sounded like a click. So we didn't really dive very deep into alternatives. We of course searched through them, like we Googled, we asked our friends who have software architecture experience, and we kind of already saw that what we are already good at is a good click for this product. So that's how we started already. We didn't really spend a lot of time on that. One thing we had to spend some time on it, though, that was the language, the technologies we had to pick. And for those, we looked into a couple of alternatives. Yeah, back then it was not a very difficult decision either. Yeah, our opinion was also the best architecture, the best technology for a product is the one that you are already good at. So because you are already skipping the learning phase.
So I imagine that if you're building up this startup and if you're iterating and learning, there's a lot of, you have to go back and actually redo, well, clean up, change, you know, what you have seen or done. But on the other hand, you have this tension of the market that you think, well, I have to make progress, I have to deliver features. And do you feel like you have enough time to actually go back and redo things, to rewrite or to, well, clean up some mess you made in the learning phases? Or is that also challenging?
Well, actually, that's one of the things that we first talked about. We already knew that one of the challenges we would have on the way was keeping up to date and being responsive to customer requests, to new features and everything. So we made sure our setup is as modular as possible. It has very few dependencies. If I want to add a new component, it's as easy as possible. So we usually need new features and we can just plug them in. And some of them are not used as much, some of them are used a lot. If it's not used a lot, sometimes we just look into it, okay, nobody's using this or this is useless, and we drop it. So we didn't really have to change, but we removed stuff.
Do you have sometimes the feeling that you have a lot of pressure from outside, schedule pressure from your customers, or is the product in a way that you don't experience that?
There is a lot of pressure. Well, I think we had our first customers around the end of the second year, and it's almost fourth year now. So it's literally like two equal phases of the company. The first 2 years was, especially from a perspective of a software engineer, it was really fun because we were just in the office, we were imagining this great tool and we were building it, and it was fun. And then we went out, we had customers, and then the real world hit us. There were deadlines, there were customers calling in. Our customers usually want to build the first project together with us. So they buy the platform and they can use it, but they want to do the first projects. So we also do some projects using our own tool that comes up with deadlines, that comes up with maintenance, that comes with support. That puts us some pressure. And yeah, we were a rookie on that as well at the beginning. Yeah, we were not great on it, and we kept iterating. And yeah, after some time, it got better. But yeah, it was painful at the beginning, and it's getting better and better every day.
In these first 2 years, we're basically doing research, and you're building out the platform. Did you somehow contact potential customers? Did you talk with them? Did you reach out to them, or did you just think you have a good idea of your previous experiences of what software should look like?
That's a real nice question, and I'm going to be very honest on that. We did some talks with some potential customers. We did talk to some people, but right now, when I look back and think about it, I would say it was not enough. That's a dilemma for most of the some of the technology companies, I would say, or software engineers. You think your tool is awesome and you build it, you release it. The real world can be different sometimes. And what I can say, the what we built on the first 2 years, some of it never was used. It was nobody needed it in the real world. So maybe we should have gotten more feedback earlier and more, and from people from different fields, maybe, or from different potential sectors or something like that. So yeah, we did it, but not enough.
Yeah, that's something that comes up quite a lot, because I think it's also hard. I mean, you hear that you should engage with customers or potential customers, but it's not that easy always. As you said, you're asking them what they want to have, and also those answers are not really a North Star for where you should go, right? So it's a little bit a fuzzy road that you have to face.
Yeah, and another challenge there is, let's say you're in the development phase and you want to get feedback from people, and they are not your customers yet, right? So you ask people, okay, this is what we are building, do you like it? And they say, oh, it's great, I would definitely buy it. And it would solve my that and that and that problem, and I would build that and that and that project. And those are the features I would expect from it. Most of the time, that list changes once they are really the customers. Because then the whole company is involved, or a lot of stakeholders is involved. And a real project is always different than an imaginary project. So yeah, that's the challenge there. You can get feedback, but the real feedback is always going to be from the real initial customers.
So, you're saying that at the beginning, you had those 2 years that you were building the backbone of your company. And then you're going out to the customer and you show them, and they like parts and they don't like some of the parts, or they don't use those parts. But how did you get the first customers, and how did you, acquire those feedback on the different parts?
Obviously, the first customers were difficult. The thing that we were lucky about is we had a good network, and our founder, this is quite experienced in Turkey, and he did a lot of projects with Microsoft. So he already some network, so he could talk to people. We could do some demos, and I don't remember now, but we kind of convinced a couple of people. But it was thanks to our network. So we didn't really run commercials or anything like that. But it was the people that we already knew.
Okay. And I know that your company is actually funded, right? So you got some initial seeding. How did that happen, and when did that happen? When did you feel that it's right to ask for external funds, and how did that help you in developing your vision and your company?
It was around the second year or something. We got investment from two people. I think you can call it seed investment, actually. It's not really a Series A. But we got investment from Murat Ihlamur and Süreyya Ciliv. Those are two big names in Turkey, actually. One of them, Murat Ihlamur, was the founder of the second biggest software company in Turkey. And he sold his company to the first biggest one, and they are building enterprise ERP software. And he did his exit, and he became an investor, and he was looking around. And he also knew Süreyya Ciliv. Süreyya Ciliv was was the CEO of Turkcell, the biggest GSM operator in Turkey. They heard about us, they looked into the product, they thought it was promising. They came in as investors. They also wanted to be involved on our day-to-day operations. So they are like our board, and they attend all our meetings, like weekly meetings, and they are literally in the process of running the company. So they're not like just investors and checking on us like every 6 months or anything, and just looking at the numbers, but they also are deeply involved in our daily work.
And did that change somehow? Did you feel that the change is how you develop the software? Did it change your course or your North Star?
Well, it didn't really change the software development part. That, yeah, they already trusted us, and yeah, we just kept on doing what we are doing. But it obviously helped a lot with finding customers. Yeah, as I said, we are thankful to our network, and it's also them, their network, and their names that got a lot of attention to the company. And yeah, when people heard that they are the investors, they were more interested.
Okay, that's really interesting, because I had another guest recently on my podcast, and his experience was quite similar, that with the funding, there came also a lot of advice and a lot of knowledge, a lot of network as well that the company can profit from. So it's not only the financial advantages that you get. If you have, I think, the right investor, it probably depends really if you have the right or the wrong fit between the investors and your company as well.
Yeah, now that you say it and I think it out loud, that's actually exactly what I wanted to say. It's not that much about the funds and money. It's the experience and perspective they are bringing in. That changes a lot. That has a very high value.
And when you talked about them, you said they actually came across your company. So were you approached by the investors, or was it the other way around that you approached the investors?
Well, our founder used to work with Murat Ihlamur, so they already knew each other. So they had the first contact, I guess. And Murat Ihlamur knew Süreyya Cilivar, other founder, so they brought each other in, I would say. But yeah, our founder knew him. They worked together before.
So when maybe one thing that's related there is what I said before, is that I think there has to be a good fit between people, be it the company and the founders and the employees and the investor, but also the employees themselves. So hiring can be quite challenging for a startup. I mean, I think it's a challenging topic per se, also for larger companies, but an individual person, obviously on a seven-person team, has much more impact than on a 700-person team, right? So how do you make sure to hire the right people? What's your approach there? And yeah, how did you hire the first several employees that you have at your company?
Yeah, you have a good point. It has been difficult. It has been one of the biggest challenges we had because of a couple of things. Well, first of all, you're a startup. And you're small, you just started out, and yeah, not many people want to do that. Like most engineers, like, they like the big names, they are working for a big company or some operator or something like that. And yeah, again, here comes in the cultural thing as well. You know, in Turkey, people communicate with their parents, their families a lot. So that plays a huge role when they are making such decisions. So especially if you're a real new graduate, for example, it's kind of difficult to explain your family, like, you're joining this company that just started 2 months ago and it's just two of them. Yeah, they don't have a product yet. And yeah, that raises eyebrows. So that's difficult. So because of that, we had a smaller pool of people that we could attract. Luckily, we could find people. But another challenge is, again, also probably Turkey specific, but the average time an employee stays at a company is quite short in Turkey. So I don't know how that is in Europe or in the States. But yeah, it's kind of also difficult to hold on to people. And especially with software, yeah, first 3, 4, 5 months is still your investment phase. You're still investing in the person. You're still training them. And if they are leaving on year one, that's a shame. Because of that, we try to be very careful while hiring people. One of the things that we valued the most during the interviews was the personality. We want to make sure the person is a good fit, and we want to make sure that the person is going to like us and is more likely to stay longer.
So maybe to wrap everything up, what do you think are the next big goals that you want to achieve with Quika right now? What are you heading towards, and what brings the next year for your company?
Well, we have around 15 customers, but it's always more, the more the better. Another challenge is the tool itself. It has been 4 years, so we need to keep adding new features and keep up with the newest technology. So those are the things that are on our roadmap.
Yeah, sounds reasonable. Yeah, from my side, I'm really happy that you have been talking with me that long. Yeah, I learned a lot about your startup. It sounds amazing. It sounds very challenging and very diverse. And I think you're doing a great job. Thanks for being on my show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting
me. Yes, thank you. Bye. I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye.